Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. Maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 29th, 2015. The Donald put his hair up pretty and stood on the stage in Boulder, Colorado last night, and somebody finally asked him about the bankruptcy of the Trump Casino Complex in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I've been waiting for this. I've wanted them to stage a debate in Atlantic City so that Chris Christie and Donald Trump could explain what happened there. And in this bizarre CNBC debate that was much more like a WWF SmackDown, full of gotcha questions, a rowdy crowd, moderators who couldn't control the crowd or the debaters, it was really strange and comical at times. But the comedy turns tragic when you see that every one of those morons up on the stage lives in some sort of a contrived reality of their own making. And this parade appears like an audition for a reality TV show where each one is trying to best the other for the producers, hoping that they'll get chosen. And there was Donald Trump, you know, ego out of control, a little less bombastic than usual. He only tweaked John Kasich and maybe one or two other candidates on the stage. But the part about Atlantic City I thought was interesting because one of the moderators brought up that Donald Trump has filed for bankruptcy. And he said, well, not me personally. And that's true. He has used the corporate bankruptcy laws, he said, four times, and I think that's accurate. And he basically just said, so what? People use bankruptcy all the time, and he claimed that he was protecting himself and his family. But no comment on the thousands of people who have lost their jobs in Atlantic City, the implosion of the casino economy, and the proliferation of casinos across the country, including on Native American reservations and places that aren't. And so there were some interesting moments when Jeb Bush took on his old pal and junior mentored partner from Florida, Marco Rubio, and said, hey, Marco, you're not showing up for work in the Senate. And while some people who reviewed the debate claim that Rubio had a great performance, I think he blustered on and bullshitted, and it was obvious in the face of many challenges. Like, he can't manage his own personal finances. And one of the moderators noted that even after he got his million-dollar book deal that he said he used to pay off his student loans, he had to raid his own retirement account. And the numbers were something like there was $60,000 in the account. It cost him $24,000 in taxes and fees to cash that out. That's a payday loan. And Rubio tries to turn it around saying, well, I'm not worried about my finances. I'm worried about the country and the people. And what's really interesting is that right out of the box, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, jumped the he just jumped the gun. He was asked a trivial question about what's your greatest weakness, and he wisely just ignored that. But he sounded the alarm that the inexperienced rivals who are leading in the polls as Republican presidential candidates don't have the experience. They're unqualified for the job. And this is what is so interesting in the dynamic between the candidates who are trying to connect with Republican voters this year. Experience, a track record, Jeb Bush talking about all the taxes he cut in Florida. I heard Rush Limbaugh this morning saying that whenever these mainline politicians tout their experience, it's a negative with the restive Republican base. Now, I think that overall, from my perspective as an independent leftist, that this makes a great opportunity for Bernie Sanders to actually win election next November. And I know that Hillary's got the superdelegates and the inside votes locked up in the party. But my hunch is that Hillary will not survive the primaries, and that scandals of her own creation, from the emails from the Clinton Foundation, will ultimately overwhelm and cause voters to look for another choice. And so with this very weak and continually weakening field of Republican candidates, where Ben Carson is the miracle guy who's going to lead the Republicans into the promised land, with his mixture of a flat tax and a kind of vague evangelistic approach, it is truly bizarre. And as I sat watching this so-called debate, and you see one parade after another, and the candidates did rightfully attack the CNBC moderators for a bunch of stupid questions. I mean, Chris Christie lit into them at one point. They were talking about fantasy football, and Jeb was bragging about he's undefeated in his fantasy football league. And Christie said, "Why are we talking about fantasy football?" And he had a point. But Ted Cruz was actually asked a significant question. But since he hadn't been able to speak before then, he used his time to attack the moderators. And he had a point. Let me find his quote here. He said, "This is not a cage match. Look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?" Now, that was a brilliant answer. Only he used it to dodge answering a question about the budget deal that has been approved by the House that has a lot of ugly shit in it, but it does end the threat of a government shutdown over the debt ceiling and a December shutdown because the budget would have expired. And we don't know where Ted Cruz stands on that. We know Rand Paul is planning to launch a filibuster today on the Senate floor. He announced that at the debate last night. And so, while it is fascinating, kind of like the slow motion of a train wreck, when you look at this and imagine that one of these people could spend 4 years as our president, it's scarier than anything you can conjure up here at Halloween time. And let me take one more whack at CNBC. James Poniewozik in the New York Times today had some good comments. He said the forum was raucous but not revealing, combative but not authoritative, chaotic but not interesting. And it ended in the nigh-impossible spectacle of conservatives accusing the Wall Street-focused business network, CNBC, of swinging the axe for the liberal media. And I thought it was bizarre when they trotted out people like Rick Santelli and Jim Cramer, the hosts of these weird stock-picking shows on CNBC. And Cramer, in particular, seemed heavily medicated. You know, usually he presents like he's just had a whole case of Red Bull, screaming, talking a mile a minute. And at the debate last night, they let him ask a couple of questions, and he clearly was reading them word for word. And somebody told him he had to go slowly. But, you know, why do you have to trot out these idiots? And in the end, in a kind of bizarre answer in his closing statement, Donald Trump noted that he had successfully forced CNBC to trim their plans for this debate to a maximum of 2 hours. And he was, you know, bragging about his negotiating skills. And he went into a long-winded explanation of $250,000 a minute for commercials, and that's why CNBC wanted a longer debate. I don't know that any of that matters, but all that passed for a discussion of business and economic and tax issues that was really disjointed and an insult to most Americans, because these individuals were not required to really explain their plans in detail. They just were subjected to a series of gotcha questions and a lot of interruption from the moderators. Well, meanwhile, the House battle over its leadership on the Republican side has finally been settled, and Paul Ryan was elected today with 236 votes. He took the gavel, and shortly afterward he said, "Let's be frank, the House is broken." Well, it is. But I have no confidence that Paul Ryan will be able to quell the restive elements of the Tea Party mob. And while they have mostly gone quietly to accept this budget deal, which offends them because there's no carve-out to defund Planned Parenthood, there's no effort to end Obamacare, there is no immigration penalties for the executive actions that the president has taken, those are all pet projects of the far right. And they have clearly lost in the Boehner to Ryan shuffle with this budget deal going through at this time. Shaka Rahmer should already be home. It was on September 25th that the administration announced that he was going to be released from Guantanamo after the 30-day notification to Congress. That time was up last Saturday, and he is still at Guantanamo. Our friend Andy Worthington, who has led the campaign to win freedom for Shaka Rahmer, is quoted in Middle East Eye today saying, "We're hearing that his release will be at the end of this week or early next week, and it was delayed because three Republican senators visited Guantanamo Bay over the weekend on a fact-finding mission, and there's a group of journalists there to attend a series of pretrial hearings, and somehow that prevents them from putting Shaka Rahmer on a plane for London?" Well, it's politics, it's bureaucracy, or it's intentional. But here's what belies that explanation, because today the government released a citizen of Mauritania, Ahmed Ould Abdelaziz, aged 45. He's been at Guantanamo for 13 years, never accused of a crime, cleared for release in 2009 like so many others. And so the bureaucracy was able to move to release Abdelaziz. But Shaka Rahmer remains trapped at Guantanamo. And the Aziz story is interesting. Like Shaka, he appears to be a guy who was just caught up in the dragnet that was induced by the bounty payments that the U.S. dropped in Pakistan and Afghanistan after 9/11. And he always protested his innocence, but Clive Stafford Smith says he believes that he was held because, as an innocent man, he routinely protested his mistreatment. And we're told that Aziz will be under mild surveillance, but is not expected to be in custody when he returns to Mauritania. And one of his compadres, Mohamedou Oud Slahi, also a Mauritanian, remains at Guantanamo. He's really in the same status as Abdelaziz. He's been cleared for release. He's never been charged or tried. But Slahi's problem is that he has published a best-selling memoir called The Guantanamo Diary. And that probably doesn't win him any cuts to the front of the line for a release from Guantanamo. Every day I like to take a moment to thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I just noticed that Perry Productions kicked in $100 over the last few days. Thank you very much, Perry Productions. You win. You win my heart today. Pauline Nixon is a monthly subscriber, along with Multitask Man and Carl Hesterberg, who just set up a new subscription. He's been with us before. And I want to thank you for your support and invite others to join in. I need your support. As I announce the people who make payments every month, I don't always tell you about the cancellation notices that I receive. But frankly, recently I've had more annual subscribers, for whatever reason, cancel their subscriptions than new signups. So I invite you to help level that playing field for me and keep the Peter B. Collins podcast going. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. The menu button is in the upper right of our zippy, newly designed website. And you click on that and then become a subscriber is your next tab. On that page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or $50 annual subscription. And you can make a one-time contribution, like Perry Productions did, of any amount using PayPal, or you can mail in a check, money order, or good old greenbacks. And don't forget, we've got the Zippy new app for iPhone and iPad. You can find it. Just look for Peter B. Collins in the App Store at Apple. Today, I'm releasing to subscribers a new in-depth interview with investigative journalist Larry Hancock. And he recently published a piece at whowhatwhy.com called Why America Will Never Hear the Entire Benghazi Story. And it's quite an eye-opener because he confirms what we have reported here on many occasions in the past. And that is that the Benghazi CIA post was coordinating the removal of Russian-era weapons from Libya, which, in many cases, have wound up in Syria. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Larry Hancock.
It would have been much more what you'd call forward-looking. I mean, let's look to the campaign and to strategic positions and your decision-making skills. Let's look to something where you really made a decision and took a stance. Whereas all this talk about, she had no command responsibilities, all this talk about her and what did she do. I saw the one questioning series where the Republican congressman was asking her, like, were you alone all night? And it's like...
Yeah, that was weird.
That's weird, and really, she's not in charge of any military forces. They shouldn't even be, not that she wouldn't follow what was going on, but those are not her decisions. If you really want to talk about that, you need to talk to the Secretary of Defense. I agree with you. It would have been much harder hitting if they used it to question her overall strategic understanding of national affairs, her decision making, or make her look like a loose cannon.
Well,
frankly, it's sort of like, the rest of the administration was really not particularly excited, and you kind of drove them into this. What's going to happen if you get elected?
You can hear the full conversation with Larry Hancock. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you find the PBC podcast. And in our discussion, Larry Hancock and I raised the questions about why Republicans have failed to challenge Hillary Clinton on the overall policy of going into Libya and taking out the Gaddafi government. And today, the Hillary campaign sent me an email notifying me that it is Hillary's birthday, and to celebrate, they're launching Let's Talk Hillary. And it's a series of new videos where you get to know the former First Lady, U.S. Senator, and Secretary of State. And, I'm fine with that. There are plenty of good things about Hillary Clinton. But my evaluation is not on whether she's nice or has a good sense of humor or has been, vilified by the right wing since she was in Arkansas 20, 30 years ago. It's what she would do as President of the United States. And what is her judgment like on critical issues like the war in Libya, the war in Syria, the war in Iraq, the one we've got going in Yemen? And if you want to talk Hillary, that's what I would like to talk about. Bernie Sanders has done something I've been waiting for years. He is now advocating the removal of marijuana completely from the Drug Enforcement Act's schedule of controlled substances. As you may know, it's a Schedule I drug right up there with cocaine and, I think cocaine is Schedule II. It's up there with LSD and methamphetamines and heroin. It's ludicrous. It always has been. And Bernie Sanders has the courage to say so. Too many Americans, he says, have seen their lives destroyed because they have criminal records as a result of marijuana use. That's wrong. That has got to change. He wants to make it a state issue. States would have the right to regulate marijuana the same way that state and local laws currently govern the sale of alcohol and tobacco. It would allow businesses in states that have legalized marijuana to use the banking system. This is a big issue. And he is calling for marijuana to be removed entirely from the schedule of controlled substances. Hillary Clinton, who's been trying to Me Too almost everything Bernie Sanders advocates, well, she's not ready for that. She's not ready to take a position on medical marijuana or on legalized recreational. She does support medical marijuana, but she's saying she wants to see how things work out in states like Colorado, Washington, and Oregon. And Martin O'Malley says he wants to put marijuana down from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 with cocaine. And I think that, you know, that's just a measly half step. Finally, a quote from Sanders, "It's time to tax and regulate marijuana like alcohol. It's time to end the arrests of so many people and the destruction of so many lives for possessing marijuana." Let's hope that one catches on. It's interesting, a federal court of appeals that in the past year issued a ruling saying that the NSA's dragnet collection of phone records of every American is unconstitutional, and the language they used was very strong. Well, the same judge issued an opinion for a three-judge panel today, Gerard Lynch, saying that the cosmetic changes in the recently passed law back in May or June that we were told was reform of the surveillance programs, really it just made a couple of cosmetic changes. They're still going to collect all the phone records. It's just the phone companies will keep them instead of the NSA. It'll take an extra two clicks for them to get your information. But as you know, that law allowed for a 180-day transition period, which basically extended the dragnet collection of metadata from phone records rather than reforming it. And that's how our Congress works these days. Back in May, Lynch wrote for the Second Circuit that the old NSA program was not authorized under the Patriot Act and violated Americans' privacy rights. But today, he says, under the circumstances, we will defer to the reasonable decision of the Congress. Thanks so much. Ed Snowden has been lauded by the European Parliament. They voted today to call on its member states to welcome him as a human rights defender. They should drop any criminal charges against Edward Snowden, grant him protection, and consequently prevent extradition or rendition, that's notable, by third parties. The U.S. isn't named, but that's what it's aimed at, in recognition of his status as a whistleblower and international human rights defender. It is a non-binding resolution. I like the sentiment of it, but it's important to note that in recent months, France, the United Kingdom, and the Netherlands have passed surveillance laws that are quite inconsistent with their honoring of Ed Snowden. In Canada, there's some interesting changes going on with the incoming Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He says he remains committed to bringing 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada by the end of this year. He's even planning to offer to airlift them in. Now, this is in contrast to the United States, which I view as the cause of the refugee migration from Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and a few other countries like Egypt if they can get out. And the U.S. is accepting, we're told, 70,000 Middle Eastern refugees this year, 85,000 in 2016, and 100,000 in 2017. Not all of these are from Syria, but these are refugees mostly of countries that are riven by war. And these are goals, pledges made by the Obama administration, but if there is a change of the guard in the White House, it could be changed dramatically. Most of the Republicans say they would not allow any Syrians or Middle Eastern refugees into the country. And meanwhile, we have another case of five children who drowned attempting to reach safety, and three adults also drowned near the island, Greek island of Lesbos last night. 30,000 refugee kids are now in Germany on their own. Their parents have not made it or are no longer alive. and Austria and Slovenia are exchanging threats over borders and the traffic of refugees through their countries as they try to get to the heart of Europe. And we haven't seen this kind of a disastrous migration problem since the end of World War II. And once again, the United States, the prime cause of all this, is doing the least to address the deep humanitarian crisis that is really causing a lot of problems in Europe and the Middle East. One other item from Canada, where the province of Ontario is considering banning what's called carding. Carding is a practice where the police stop and collect identifying information on people without apparent cause. The new regulations would prohibit such stops, require police to document every time they collect data, and to issue a receipt to the person they talk to. Now, we have a similar law that's going into effect in a couple of years here in California, and I support it because the way they describe carding, it's a form of racial profiling. And the Toronto Star has exposed how the carding process disproportionately affects people with non-white skin. The draft regulation would also require cops to provide people they stop a document that says their name and ID number, the date, time, location, reason for the collection, information about how the person can reach the independent police review director in case they want to file a complaint. The only thing that's missing is a videotape. Or at least a reference to the video file on the cop's body camera. And speaking of police, I am still pleased that the Guardian newspaper is counting the number of Americans killed by police officers this year because our government fails to do it and doesn't really have a strong interest in correcting that. At the counted feature, and I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast if you want to catch up with the latest count, 943 Americans have been killed by police this year, 73 in the month of October alone, and we've still got a few days left. A recent poll shows that views are shifting about gun control in this country. 58% of Americans now support stronger gun laws. Now, those are not defined. It's a pretty vague question the way it's asked. But that's up from 52% in December of 2013. About 80% of Democrats surveyed expressed support for stronger gun regulations, compared with 46% of moderate and liberal Republicans. Among all Republicans, 20% thought existing gun laws should be less strict. 41% say they favor no change. Now, I want to know about this poll where they found moderate and liberal Republicans to respond. I haven't seen any evidence of those endangered species cavorting across the great fruited plains of America in a long, long time. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast that you're free to share with absolutely everyone. Put it up on the Facebook thing, tweet it out to all your Twitter fans. And join me again tomorrow right here for more of my ranting and raving. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.